it wasn't even called cloud computing. It wasn't even called on-demand computing. At the time, it was just stuff over the internet. We were paid almost nothing, barely surviving, sleeping on couches, just trying to get by.
Hello, everyone. This is Byron Dieter, and you are listening to Cloud Giants, brought to you by Bessemer Venture Partners. This is a podcast where we talk to entrepreneurs, founders, and great leaders who have built world-changing cloud companies. I am so damn excited to be here today with Adam Miller, one of the OGs of cloud computing. He's the founder and CEO of Cornerstone On Demand, and I've got to tell you, when I decided to launch this podcast, there was zero doubt who guest number one needed to be. I hopped on a plane and came down here to sunny Southern California to interview Adam. Because of his background, not only as a great CEO and founder, but as an amazing parent, father, and a great personal friend. Adam is one of those amazing self-made stories where he built Cornerstone into a multi-billion dollar public company, literally from credit card debt, near-death experiences, and countless crazy adventures along the way, many of which we hope to get into today. But there's also a personal reason why Adam had to be my first guest. Because he bet on me years ago when allowing me to make an investment on behalf of Bessemer Venture Partners into Cornerstone. And after many fun and wild years together, Adam was my first CEO to go public. And they say you always remember your first. And Cornerstone was my first IPO and my first home run investment. And for that, I will always be appreciative and grateful to Adam. So welcome, Adam. Awesome to have you on the show here today.
Thanks, Byron. Great to be here.
So I'm eager to dive into this crazy journey that involved the dot-com crash, bank implosions, and a literal nuclear meltdown. But before we get into that, let's get a little bit of the genesis story in the background. So when it comes to founding a company, I always love a great story. And so let's go back and start in that one bedroom where you founded Cornerstone On Demand, or more precisely, CyberU. What the heck were you thinking, and what was the early vision?
I was an investment banker at the time, and I loved technology, I loved education, I'd gone through a lot of schooling, and I was completely convinced that the internet would transform the way people learned. The question at the time was, do you want to create training, or do you want to distribute training, and do you want to do it for kids, for university students, or for adults? And my conclusion was, kids go to school, university students are obviously in school, but adults often don't have good access to education and yet needed to keep learning throughout their lives. That's much more true today than it was 20 years ago. But even back then, it was true that people had to keep learning. And so was there a way to use the internet to make it easier for people to learn throughout their lives? We decided it was, and that distributing training was going to be more relevant because there were a lot of universities at the time that were producing online classes, but there was not good distribution of that training. It was hard to find, it was hard to assess, it was hard to curate, and we were gonna make that easier. So the idea was CyberU, Cyber University, to bring together all the online content that was gonna be generated in the world to adults, whether they be at home as individuals, part of a small business, or inside a large corporation. That was the original business plan, that was the idea. It took us 20 years to actually do that, but that was where we started.
And there were at least two semi-contrarian parts of that bet, one of which was as you layered in the corporate customers, the target, when most of the world was thinking consumer back then. And then the second was on demand, before SaaS or cloud even existed as terms, you were thinking of this delivery model. And so how bold did those feel as bets? Did it feel like those were bet the company decisions or that there was a pivot in there? Or was this an incremental evolution that each small step felt okay along the way?
At the time, the thought was we will start with the website. It was 1999. The internet 1.0 was all the rage. And we were going to start consumers. So the first people I hired were web developers. And we started building out a website. We hired students from UCLA and USC to come in after school, surf the web. This was pre-Spiders, pre-Google. And try to identify training that was out there. We'd put it into our database and make it available to people as individuals. So it was a B2C site. Our timing wasn't too good because we started the company in November of 99. And as you might remember, by March of 2000, the internet bubble had burst. So we were 10 people at the time, mostly interns, and trying to build something on the internet that had just exploded. So we realized we have to shift the model and focus more on the B2B side. And so we started going to companies, trying to ask them, what do they need that would make it effective for them to be able to consume this training? And so our thought at the time, we were really small, was that we would go to people we knew, most of them worked at large corporations, and find out from them what would be helpful to build for small businesses to use. Because we'd have no ability to sell these big companies, we were too small. And we did that. We had lots of meetings, mostly in New York, where Stephen Seymour, the original sales guy at Cornerstone, and I would work both in New York and in LA. I had a two-bedroom apartment in LA where he stayed. He had a two-bedroom apartment in New York where I stayed. And we'd fly back and forth every 2 weeks, listening to people. What did they need? What would make them more effective to leverage the internet, leverage the training that was available out there, doing it online instead of in a classroom, to be much more effective, but using a tool to do it. And we thought at the time that we were going to distribute the content and give away any tools that we created. We went to Stephen's friends and they introduced us to their HR people, and they would tell us all the things they wanted built. They would say, you know, you have all this training, that's great, but we need to make sure that the salespeople aren't taking tech classes and the engineers aren't taking sales classes. We need to make sure that, what about the training in the classroom? It needs some way to be tracked. We need to give people options. We need to make sure if the course is expensive, there are controls or approvals. We need to make sure that if somebody doesn't show up in a class that we paid for, they're somehow penalized. So all of these things got built into the system. How did we build them? We built them on the website. Remember, we had a B2C site. We had web developers. The web developers would add more and more capabilities to the website to make it easier for people to use. And after a while of doing this, and I mean many, many, many trips back and forth, where we would go to New York, talk to people, show them what we had. They would say, this is great, that's great, but you got to change this thing and you're missing that thing. On the way back, I draw screenshots on cocktail napkins on the airplane, get back to LA, hand it to the developers. They'd work on it. And so every 2 weeks, we'd come with a new product. People would say, that's great, or you need to change it. And we would get better and better stuff. But we never thought that the people we were talking to would have any interest in it. We always thought we'd be selling to small businesses. After doing this for a while, these people started to say, you know, we could really use this. And we thought, obviously you could use it. It's been designed by you, but you're never going to buy it from us. We're too small. And they were very persistent. And eventually we realized there's a real opportunity here. These people are actually willing to buy something from us. We were very bad at sales back then. We didn't understand buying signals or the fact that a small company can actually sell to a big company. And our first clients were lined up to be some of the largest financial services companies in America. We thought, okay, we have this stuff. We built it over the web. We can deliver something that's fairly incredible to these people. And we had lined up this great pipeline of potential clients in August of 2001, all Northeast financial service firms. Now, you have to remember that we had very little capital. We had raised almost no money. The money we got was friends and family, and we really needed these sales to be able to keep operating. And then September 11th happened. Our entire pipeline was effectively gone, right? Northeast financial service firms. But we, on September 12th, had a lot of pressure. I was told by my management team, by every advisor we had, by every investor we had, Adam, you got to cut the business. There's no way you're going to make it through this. You have very little capital. Cut the staff down to the minimal number of people. Now, you have to remember, we had very few people to begin with. So cutting the staff down would mean if we continued to operate and we actually closed even one of these deals, we wouldn't be able to deliver to that client. So on September 15th, I came back to work and I said, we're hiring. And we started hiring more people. We ended up closing three of the four deals we were working on right at the end of 2001. Had we fired the people in the company at the time, we never would have been able to service those accounts. Those accounts ended up being the capital for the business, and we grew the company from there.
So you have this awesome reputation of letting customers define roadmap and guiding you into the market. Not only in this case did it shape where the product went, but customer financing is also the best form of financing you get for business, and you were amazingly successful at getting material customers to pay early and help fund the business. But it didn't make up for the full gaps. There were bets there where you needed to go out and get some financing. And in addition to surviving the dot-com crash and the financial crisis and September 11th, there was a roller coaster on the financing side that I think our current entrepreneurs may not appreciate with the benefit of the last decade plus of this bull market. Talk a little bit about what the financing environment was like back then and how you pulled together financing to hire the incremental heads along the way.
Until you were dumb enough to give us the first money in true venture capital, I spent between November of 99 and May of 2007, when you made the investment, at least half my time trying to raise money. I don't say raising money, I say trying to raise money, because it was virtually impossible. At the time, the Valley VCs had no interest in investing outside of the Valley. We were in LA.
And the on-demand cloud wave was still extremely early.
It wasn't even called cloud computing. It wasn't even called on-demand computing. At the time, it was just stuff over the internet. And on the one hand, we had something that was very unique. But on the other hand, 90% of the time that we went to pitch a company about what we had created, the IT department would find out what we were doing and say, this is great. We'll use it when you give us the software. And we'd say, no, you don't get it. You don't get our software. It's over the internet. And they said, well, if it's over the internet, that means you have our data outside our firewall. We can't have that. And the conversation would end and we'd lose the account. And this happened over and over and over again. In fact, every deal that we did was the first time that company, and these were Fortune 500 companies, first time that company had ever used any what today is considered cloud computing. The contracts that we would receive from these companies would include things like, you are liable if you break the equipment in our data center. And we said, we don't go to your data center. We don't use any of your equipment. We had to teach the finance people this was not a capital expenditure and that you did not have to go to the capital commitment committee. Rather, you expensed it. We ended up realizing that we had to use our paper to do the contracts, even though we were working with much bigger companies, because we were starting from such an absurd place if we used their paper. So we started negotiating the contracts. We taught them about cloud computing. And every single deal we did, probably the first 50 clients we had, we were the first and only cloud computing company they were using. And that enabled us to keep growing the business. And so we were growing by necessity based on the deals that we were doing. So if we won a deal, we'd get the revenue from that deal and we would use that to hire more people. But by 2005, it was apparent that we had a real opportunity. There was product market fit. We were selling very well. We had a lot of really big clients and it made sense to go faster. So we wanted to get more capital, not just do one deal at a time or one person at a time, but start to hire people more quickly. And so I went on a full attempt to raise money up and down Sand Hill Road, all throughout LA, many trips to New York. We had many near funding opportunities, all of which went away. We had hired a bank to work with us. And the bank said, look, this is a great story. We're going to be able to help you get financing. Why'd I hire a bank? Because all my attempts to do it by myself didn't work. And so we found this boutique bank in Los Angeles that said, look, we'll help you out. We'll get the money for you. And so we started to spend based on the assumption that we were going to get the money. I didn't really understand how venture capital worked at the time. We had a bunch of early meetings. People seemed very interested. I didn't really understand that until you got to present to all the partners, you really weren't talking to the final decision makers. And we ended up having a meeting one day with the bank. I remember getting called in. We were running out of money. And the lead banker sits me down and says, Adam, I know this has been a lot of work for you, but I have to be honest, we're not going to be able to get you money. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we've tried. We have a lot of other clients. We're kind of busy. I don't think we're going to be able to do this. I said, I don't understand. Are you firing us? And he said, well, I wouldn't put it that way, but we're not going to be able to work with you anymore. We were the client. I remember leaving that meeting totally despondent, thinking, what are we going to do? This is 2005. We probably at the time had 45 people. We did not have enough money to stay in business. So I call our early investors and they say, all right, we'll give you bridge financing, but only if you raise, I think it was $750,000. We'll give you money, but you have to put it in escrow. Unless you have $750,000, you can't take the money down. I said, all right, fine. And through those early investors, we were able to raise $600,000. I then scraped together another $50,000. We were short $100,000. And I went to every single person I knew and every person that they knew and everyone that they knew. And I could not raise $100,000. So I get a call. I'm in New York trying to raise money from everybody I knew and anybody I'd ever met and anybody they knew. I'm sitting at a restaurant. I get a call from my CFO who says, it's over. We're missing payroll. I said, what do you mean? He said, payroll's due today. We do not have the money. We're done. You can't miss payroll and keep running a business, especially when you're paying people. It's against the law. So I said, are you sure? There's no way we could get this $100,000. He said, you've gone to everybody you know. We're done. And I was sitting at lunch and I was very depressed. And one of my friends says, do you really need the money? And I said, yeah, the company's going to go out of business if I don't get the money. He goes, well, I know this guy. Here's his number. You can only do this if you really, really need the money. My friend had a gambling problem. And so he sent me to this loan shark. And I go to the meeting. The guy looks me up and down, asks me lots of questions. And at the end of it says, you know what? I think you're good for it. You personally. And wires $100,000 the next day. We had missed payroll already.
Unbelievable. On a personal guarantee.
On a personal guarantee, wired the money. His interest rate, I think, was 2% a day. It was over 100% interest and full warrant coverage. That guy made over $1 million from his one day investment. We got the money in the wire, in the escrow account, pulled down the escrow, paid the guy back, paid payroll, and live to fight another day.
That's just awesome. So was there ever a point where you legitimately said, this just isn't working? I mean, I remember when we invested, I think your personal credit cards were line items on the balance sheet. You were so leveraged.
Yeah, the way I started the company, because I had very little capital, is before I quit my job, I signed up for every credit card I could and then maxed out every single credit card. And I remember Steven was in the same situation. He was completely, to say bankrupt would be understating it. He was in massive credit card debt. They had put a lien on his bank accounts. He owed federal taxes. The guy probably should have been in prison. And this was how we were doing business. We were paid almost nothing, barely surviving, sleeping on couches, just trying to get by.
And you were a former banker. There was no point where you said, this just isn't going to work. We need to go back and get real jobs.
We thought about it. In 2005, I had my first child. And when my son was born, I thought, you know, we've been doing this for a while and we're not getting very far. At the time, we had reasonable revenue, 8 to 10 million in revenue. We thought this is worth trying to grow, but we were just going sideways. We ended up, we listened to some webinar on sales. Perry had said, hey, there's this webinar on sales and we should probably watch it because we don't really know very much about sales.
As some founder is going to do out there today listening to you.
And we do the webinar and we're like, that guy's really smart. Why don't you call him and see if he'll come and meet with us? Perry calls him and the guy's conditions were, I have to have you, Perry, and Steven in the room together for a full day. And we're like, we can't afford a full day. And he said, I don't care. The only way I'm doing this is if I get a full day and you're in a separate conference room and you have no meeting scheduled. We're like, all right. Within an hour of the meeting, the guy had written on the board 12 months to live. He said, you guys are idiots. You're screwing around with this crappy little internet company. You're not going anywhere. Like, let's either do this thing or not. 12 months to live. We're going to run this thing to the edge of the cliff. We're either going to make it work or we're done. We're turning out the lights and you guys can go get real jobs. By midnight that night, we had hired the guy as our VP of sales and temporarily. And so he served as our interim VP of sales. And that's when the company started taking off. We ended up growing the business 60% that year. And it proceeded to grow 60% a year from 2005 through 2014, 60% a year, year after year after year. You guys came in at 2007. That's when the fun really started. But it was, at that moment, we thought, like, are we going to just keep doing this? Or should we really build out this business? And that was the pivotal moment where we said, let's really try to do this thing.
So let's drill down to that phase, the scale and the team building and the hypergrowth phase. These things always look great from the benefit of the NASDAQ podium and the rearview mirror here. But there was a pretty wild journey along the way as you scaled this out. And I want to get into the lessons learned and some of the advice there. And let's start with that team building element first.
So we had not hired many people, right? We had, I think, 45 people between 1999 and 2005. We had very, very good retention, but we were building a business, a tech company in LA at a time when LA had no tech scene. And so it was impossible to hire people that had the exact experience for the jobs that we had posted. And so what we had to do was hire for potential. And the people that were most successful at our company were people who learned to evolve. And none of us really had any idea what we were doing. The whole management team effectively learned together. We learned from each other. There were no mentors. There was nobody to mentor us in LA, and we didn't know anybody in tech. So we kind of helped each other. It was more of a band of brothers kind of situation. In 2005, we knew the company was starting to grow quickly, and we knew we were going to start hiring a lot of people. And I remember sitting down and deciding with somebody, actually I had been coached by Julie Brent, that you were going to have a corporate culture, and it was either going to be a culture by accident or a culture by design. But either way, you were going to have a culture. And we were moving into a time when we were going to start to hire very quickly. And we were going to go, I remember one year, we were going to go from 45 to 51, and then from 51 to 150. So we're going to triple the size of the company. And what I've learned over the years is that it's never about the absolute number of people. It's always about the relative number of people. Are you adding 10% more people, 50% more people? The higher the percentage, the more of an impact that influx is going to have on the culture of the business. So at that time, we decided we wanted a culture that was smart, cool, dependable, and visionary. It was actually somewhat controversial because everybody knew what smart meant. Everyone knew what dependable is, and people understood what visionary meant. But what was controversial was cool. What did cool mean? And so I remember writing one night a manifesto on what smart, cool, dependable, and visionary meant and posting it literally to the refrigerator. This was back when we had 50 people. And that became the mantra for the business. So we started to say, this is our requirement. And so we had many people who started, joined the company, they seemed smart, they had a dependable history, but they weren't cool. Those people got fired. We had people who were very cool, pretty smart, but not dependable at all. Those people got fired.
Let's talk about the other side of this. You talked about the evolution of your execs and how you gave them the opportunity to grow with the company. But inevitably, there were times where you needed to bring in people above them or bring in leadership, et cetera. And let's talk about divorce as part of that. Not personal divorce. Stacy's awesome. But founder divorce. What happens when a co-founder or a very early employee isn't scaling with the job you need them to do?
You know, at the end of the day, I learned a lesson a long time ago, which is what comes around goes around, and that people often aren't given credit for what they know. So most employees are in fact self-aware, and most employees know what's going on. So you might think, oh, I figured something out that nobody knows, so I'm not going to tell anyone. They already know. In situations like that, you just have to be really transparent. First of all, talk about it early. You got to talk about it often. You got to make sure you're doing something that's not just in the best interests of the team, but also that person. Often, if it's not the right fit anymore, it's not only not the right fit for you, it's not the right fit for them anymore either. They're going to do better. They're going to be happier if they move out to something else. We've had many employees who have been with us for many, many years. We do 7 weeks for 7 years. We do a sabbatical for the employees. And the number of people on sabbatical this past year is extraordinary. There's great loyalty in the business both ways. That's part of the corporate culture. It's part of what's made us successful. But even that has to have limits. And so you have to understand when it's no longer the right fit for somebody. And hopefully you have the relationship where you can have that honest conversation. Now, sometimes it means you got to bring in somebody over them because they can't scale. Sometimes it means they might want to be a manager, but really they're much better as an individual contributor. Maybe you gave them a shot to be a manager and it didn't work out. Look, these are your choices. You could be an individual contributor or you go somewhere else, but you can't be a manager here. There might be a time where you've had two people, both of whom had done a really good job in the role they're at. Somebody above them leaves and they both want that job. Only one of them is going to be able to get it. And so how do you make the decision between two people who have both done a phenomenal job when there's only one opening and you know whoever you pick, the other person's going to leave? You have to make decisions. Part of the job of being CEO is to make decisions. And so at the end of the day, you have to use the information you have. You have to use the relationships you have. And you have to use your gut and make decisions about these things. I'm very fortunate that even over the years where we've had exits, we've had people leave, I'd say 90% of the time, not 100% of the time, but 90% of the time, we've maintained great relationships with those people. And I think it's a testament to what we've built over the years and how important those relationships were during those times. But as the business scales, eventually there are new skills that you need to bring in. And often you want some new insights. So we kept a policy, just it's kind of another cultural thing, where we try to do 50-50, hire from the outside and promote from the inside. So that it's not all new people where nobody internally has any opportunity, but it's not all promotion, because you need to get new blood, you need to get new ideas and new experiences from the outside. And sometimes we make mistakes, like that sales guy. And if you make the mistake, you got to deal with the mistake quickly. Hire slowly, fire fast.
Let's shift gears to think about the 20-year arc of Cornerstone and one decision you could change if you could go back in history. It could be people, strategy, or otherwise. Is there one thing that you would reverse and do differently with the benefit of hindsight?
I think I probably could have replicated the 20 years in like 7 if I were to do it again. We made a lot of mistakes along the way. We probably should have raised capital much sooner. We could have gotten aggressive much sooner. We could have gone more international sooner. But probably my biggest regret is how we treated one of our early managers, who was one of our earliest people and one of my best friends growing up. This was one of those cases where it just wasn't working out. It wasn't a great fit. There wasn't a perfect role for that person. we had to part ways, and it probably was not handled well. And if I could go back in time, I probably would have handled that differently, where either given him more time to find something else or put him in a different role. Today, it would have been much easier to do. Back then, we had very few people and so very few positions, so it was harder to do. But that ruined a friendship. And so that probably more than anything else is what I would go back and change. But there are many, many mistakes we made along the way in terms of how we ran the business, decisions we could have made differently, the way we incentivize people. We probably overpaid in certain respects and underpaid in others. The way we handled some of our programs, the way we did some of our product management, we allowed for too long our clients not to help us with the roadmap. We really drive all product development based on what our clients need and what our clients are telling us, but allowing individual clients to hijack the roadmap, we probably were too generous with that. It took us 5 years, I would say, to get good at not doing that, because you end up doing things for one client at the expense of all the others. And as the client base gets bigger, you realize that one client might be 0.1% of the client base and not 10 or 15% of the client base. And so you can't do that. You got to really be looking out for the 99%. We've gotten much better at all of those things, but we still have a lot to learn. And I think one of the reasons we're still around is that at every turn, we've tried to build to last. There were lots of times we could have taken shortcuts, but that would have worked for 6 months or a year, maybe 2 years. It never would have enabled us to stay around for 20 years.
So that answers a powerful reminder that despite building a multi-billion dollar business, that a lot of this is still personal and a lot of the people bets are personal. A lot of that is trusting you to come on board and vice versa. That's powerful. Serious question for you to build on this. What's the worst advice I ever gave you? And when did you realize it, and how did you ignore it or abandon it?
So I'll tell you a funny story, because right around the time that you invested, we said one of the reasons we wanted venture capital is we wanted to go international. And we had this dream of having a global business. And we thought what we did, which is help companies recruit, train, and manage their employees, is something that is applicable to any business around the world. I started asking people for advice about going international, and everybody gave me the exact same advice. Whatever you do, don't hire people in France. Everyone said the same thing. And then Byron comes along and says, I have the perfect guy to run your international team. I said, okay, great. He said, he's Canadian, he'll be amazing, he could run your international team. I'm like, all right, fine. I meet the guy, great conversation, super smart. He had worked with Byron before. I thought, okay, I might be over-trusting this new venture capitalist. I heard a lot of threats about what the VCs might do to the company, but I thought, you know what? Byron seems like a cool guy. This guy, Vincent, seems really smart. Maybe I'll go for it. Turns out Vincent lives in Paris. So then I think, all right, fine. I have one guy in France, it won't be a big deal. Vincent immediately hires people he knows who are all in Paris. And so we end up with this giant team proportionally in France when everybody said, whatever you do, don't build a team in France. I'm proud to say that we have gone against conventional wisdom. And France, believe it or not, is our number two market in the entire world.
And amazingly, 15 years later, Vincent's still with the company, an amazing contributor and leader.
And the team, yeah.
So, you are kind that in that case, conventional wisdom be damned, and it worked out. So thank you for not totally skewering me with the example. So let's jump ahead to 2010. You had the line of sight that year to $44 million of GAAP revenue. And so naturally, the decision was to go public. Right. Why then? What were you thinking?
Well, you remember the story there. Why don't you tell the story of what your lawyer said when I first started talking to you? The first time I hired an attorney to incorporate the company, I wanted to make sure that we were incorporated such that we'd be able to go public.
he remembered that as one of the most shocking statements for a first meeting he'd ever had.
I think part of this was when I was growing up, my dad used to teach me how to read the stock tables in the newspaper. Yeah, I'm that old. I always thought it was really cool. I learned how to invest. I loved the idea of investing. I loved the idea of the NASDAQ. I thought someday I'm going to be on the NASDAQ. And so it was kind of a goal from the very beginning. I don't know why. I think it was because of that experience growing up. And so it never crossed my mind that we wouldn't go public. Now, the reason 2010 was relevant is because we're already two leaders in our space. SuccessFactors had gone public and was doing very well. Taleo had gone public and was doing very well. And I became convinced that there was room for one more talent management company to go public in our space. And that was going to be it. And there was a pack of companies that were around our size. We were actually probably the smallest of the companies around our size. And I thought, this is a race. We're now in a sprint to see who goes public because only one of us is going to be able to go public. But at the same time, we wanted to do a tier one IPO. So we wanted a top bank. To me, that meant Goldman Sachs. And so we convinced Goldman Sachs to be willing to take us public. And we managed to get public March 17th, 2011. We were the first of that group to go public. And my prediction proved correct because immediately after that, the number two guy, our number one competitor, was acquired by SuccessFactors. Immediately after, another one was acquired by Taleo, and all the other companies started to merge together, and we became the last man standing in that pack.
So $44 million in GAAP revenue, as our listeners know, understates the progress a little bit. There was a CARR and an ARR leading component there, but that was still in the 50s. Many companies today are choosing to stay private, not only above $100 million of ARR, but in some cases to $200 and $300 million. What advice do you have to those CEOs and for the boards you sit on or people that come to ask for you for perspective? What's your coaching on when to go public and why?
So as you know, one of the reasons those companies are able to be private is after our IPO, two things happened in the venture world. One, people started to invest much more at a later stage or write much bigger checks to companies that had $50 million in revenue or were on track to $50 million in ARR. The other thing that happened is people started getting on planes to invest in companies in Salt Lake, in Austin, in Boulder, in LA, and elsewhere because there was real opportunity to build enterprise software companies outside of Silicon Valley. Those two things, I think, led to this late stage venture boom that's happened where companies are getting very high valuations as private companies. You have this explosion of unicorns, and that has enabled companies to be both private and liquid, which used to not be true. It used to be that you were either private or you were liquid, but not both, meaning it was very difficult to sell your shares as a private company. Today, that's not true. It's actually relatively easy to sell secondary shares and get liquidity as a founder or even as an employee of one of these private large-scale companies. The truth is the time to go public is when it is advantageous to the business, number one, either because you're competing with other public companies, it helps with corporate viability, it helps with sales, it helps with marketing and awareness of the business. But number two, it's also got to be a time where you're good at predicting revenue. This is particularly true for cloud businesses, but it's true generally for tech companies today. There is an expectation of precision in guidance that's far beyond anything in the past. You have an opportunity to deviate by about 0.1%. If you're off on your numbers by 1%, you're going to have a major hit to your share price. You have to be good at predicting your results. And so what I always advise CEOs and CFOs to do, if they're thinking about going public, every quarter, write on a post-it what number you think you're going to have at the end of the quarter and put it in a drawer. And you should do it. Your CFO should do it. If there's guys in finance you want to play along, they should do it too. And after you get it right three quarters in a row, you're ready to go public. It's much harder than people think. A lot of people think, oh yeah, I predicted what we would do. But I mean down to the dollar. Can you predict what your sales are going to be, what your ARR is going to be, what you're going to spend a quarter later right now? And the only way to be honest about it is if it's written down on a piece of paper, not on your computer where you could change the number, but on a piece of paper where it's untouched, and get a neutral judge to make sure you were right.
And this includes bookings. GAAP revenue obviously lags. That's much easier to predict. But you're talking about the leading indicator that you may not show to Wall Street for a couple of quarters because of the lag, but you want to test, do you know what's coming?
Do you know what's coming? Yeah, you need to know what new ARR are you going to have? What churn are you going to have? What expense are you going to have? And be super accurate. The level of accuracy can't be understated in the public markets today.
Now, let's go back to that IPO moment itself, because nothing's ever come easy in the Cornerstone journey. You talked about the dot-com crash. You talked about September 11th. You glossed over the financial crash in 08, which you absorbed and were fundraising in and during.
Well, you might remember that in August of 2008, you and I decided not to... this is some bad advice you gave. August of 2008, you and I decided not to take Excel's preemptive bid for incremental financing. And in September 2008, you had the bank collapse and venture capital went out the window for the next year. We ended up raising money in January of 2009. We were one of the only companies to be able to raise money at that time, but it was a flat round and it was expensive.
Absolutely. And the and if you fast forward from there, you go into your IPO process itself. You talked about filing in 2010. And there was discussion, the original goal was to go public in December of that year, and there was a Thanksgiving call from the bankers that wasn't terribly well received, and then...
Oh, it was a terrible. I was at home. It was Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, which is always on a Thursday. We are gearing up to have Thanksgiving, and then literally that Monday hit the road for the IPO. We're with family and friends, super excited. I get the phone call from Goldman Sachs, says... Adam, we're sorry. You can't go public next week. I'm like, what are you talking about? They said, you don't get it. You're not accurately forecasting your numbers. And whether it's too high or too low, it doesn't matter. You don't understand the level of accuracy that you need. You're not prepared to go public. And we went ballistic. We got talked off the ledge and ended up waiting and actually went public in March of 2011, so several months later. And everything was geared up for the IPO. We were ready to go. The window was opening. It was going to be great. And everyone said, okay, everything is fantastic. Unless there's a nuclear meltdown, this is going to be a very successful IPO. So we're on the road. We start out in Europe. We're oversubscribed before we even come back to the US. We're feeling really good. We're going to raise the price. It's Sunday night. Monday, we're supposed to raise the price. And on Thursday, we're supposed to like finish the IPO. So it would price Wednesday and we go public Thursday. On Sunday night, I get a call. Adam, sorry, we're not able to raise the price. So what do you mean? He said, actually, I think we might have to lower the price. So what do you mean? I thought we were doing so well. He says, turn on the TV. The tsunami had just hit Japan and the nuclear reactors in Japan were melting down, literally.
I remember when you called me right after that, you were literally just laughing. You said, yep, the one thing that we haven't encountered yet, we just did.
Exactly. And every other company that was on the road that week to go public pulled their IPO. And we said, you know what? Screw it. We've been waiting this long. We got the party planned. Let's just do it. We ended up going public that Thursday. We did, in fact, raise the price, and the stock was up 50% at open, and it was off to the races.
So the story does have a very happy ending. March 17th, 2011, you walk out of the NASDAQ offices after having hit the buzzer and open the stock. It's trading up. There's people all out on the streets in Times Square with green beer, since it happened to also be St. Patrick's Day. It seemed like the world was partying with us. And you look up on the wall in Times Square, and your photo's 100 feet into the air on the NASDAQ screen. What's going through your mind after, you know, this crazy journey and that moment in Times Square?
I mean, that moment was definitely a highlight of my career, both the ringing the bell. At the time, NASDAQ said we had the most people ever in the room. Now it's become commonplace, but at the time, we had invited every employee that was in that first 50 employees in the company, and every employee of the year, and every seed investor in the company. And we filled the room. It was an amazing opportunity. Seeing that on the screen, it was just incredible. The whole day, the whole experience was just absolutely incredible. It was exactly what we dreamed of. For us, it was not an exit. It was graduation. Like, I always think of it as college graduation, like super exciting, super fun, lots of opportunity ahead, but a real milestone. And we lived it up.
So I want to go to a speed round in a minute. I'm going to do some rapid fire questions for you. But is there anything we missed, or have there been any lessons learned that you want to make sure to share with our founders and CEOs out there who are starting a business, launching a business, or wrestling with many of the things you faced?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of it has to do with passion. You have to do something that you're truly passionate about, because there's going to be good times, but there's also going to be bad times. I like to say that good entrepreneurs need to have the three P's. They need to have passion, they need to have persistence, and they need to have perseverance. And I'll even throw in a fourth one: they need to be persuasive, because you got to persuade employees, investors, clients, partners. You have to persist, because not all the times are going to be good times. You have to persevere, because it's a long road, typically, to be successful. A lot of the big cloud companies that we think of today have been around for a long time. It did not happen overnight. Even though they might seem like overnight successes, it's taken a while. And you got to persuade. The other thing is, you got to have balance. You got to have balance, because if you get too cocky when things are good, nobody's going to be around when things are bad. And if you get too depressed when things are bad, nobody's going to be around for the good times. And so it's important to maintain balance. And I think you've been a great partner with me on that journey of trying to just stay balanced, have good time when you can, dig in when you have to, and make sure that you're not being too extreme. Because at the end of the day, the CEO is the role model for the rest of the business. And if they see you be too volatile one way or another, that's the way the company is going to start to operate. And that's not a good place to be. Because even companies that look like, from the outside, that they've gone straight up to the right and have been successful from day one, the reality is it's a roller coaster. There are good days and bad. No matter how successful a company is, there are good days and bad. And sometimes it's the success that makes the problems, right? You're too successful, so people make a lot of money. How do you retain those people? You get a lot of new clients. How do you service all those clients? You have way more employees. How do you manage all those employees at scale? And part of it is just maintaining balance all throughout the journey. And that's what it is at the end of the day. It's a journey. So don't long for the destination. Love the journey.
You've done a great job of keeping balance and also embodying the cool in the original corporate values. And so I want to go into some rapid fire questions now. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want the first answer that comes to your head. You ready?
Go for it.
I know you love AC/DC. What's your favorite song?
Thunderstruck.
First job?
Working at the A&P, which is a grocery store, stocking shelves and getting the carts back into the store.
When you went through the most challenging time as an entrepreneur, who was the one person externally who gave you advice or support you really needed?
You.
Favorite thing to do in LA?
Go to the beach.
What's the go-to single must-read book for every new founder out there?
Innovator Solution. That's sort of how we base the business. The other one I love is Built to Last.
Where do you want to be 5 years from now?
5 years from now is a long time in the tech world, as you know. I think we are clearly on path to be over $1 billion in revenue. We are getting more and more global. We are really starting to have an impact. And I would love to deliver over 1 billion trainings to over 100 million people.
If you could send your current self a voice memo from your past self, no longer than 15 seconds in length, with some advice, what would it be?
Remember to have fun and don't take yourself too seriously.
Adam, thank you. You are awesome for being here. I'm so thrilled to have had you as my first guest on Cloud Giants. Thank you for the partnership and, as much as anything, the friendship through the years. And keep kicking ass.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks so much for listening to Cloud Giants. Be sure to rate and review the show, and if you want to learn more about Bessemer Venture Partners and the cloud industry, you can find me on Twitter at @bdieter or go to our website at bvp.com/cloud. Cheers.